good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, and we'll bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It's Thursday, March 4th, 2021. I believe I have Dave with me. Good afternoon, Dave. Well, maybe I don't. We had a hard time. Okay, so we had a little difficult time connecting earlier today, so I'll let them figure that out. But we can go ahead and get started with the market report. And, you know, it was just one of those days where, you know, the Federal Reserve guy, that Jerome Powell, makes a comment and you know, the markets came a little unglued temporarily and so forth. And, you know, these are all knee-jerk reactions to a lot of it. And, you know, we also have to look to the bond market and see what's happening there. So, yes, we had another pullback in gold today, and we do need to be able to find a bottom here. And but all fundamentals, all projections of 3,000 gold and 5,000 gold are still online. Higher prices for silver are still online. So we had gold fall back today, $12, and it was up. It was up $24 earlier today. So it did break $16.99. Now, this is in the New York spot price aftermarket numbers. So you might see some different pricing in the spot close. But the New York spot price aftermarket, $16.99.50. Silver was down 73 cents at $25.45. Platinum was down 41 at $11.26. Palladium was down 13 at $2,399. The USDX today was up big. Remember, we had a day before that was up a little bit more than this. Today it is 0.66. So we're at 91.63, ready to hit on 92. So again, another reason we had pressure on gold. Crude oil today was up $2.82. How about that? $2.82 at $64.17. The paper markets today, you have the Dow had a little bit of a pullback. We're looking at 480. You know, it was down 500. It came back. I'm going to wait just a few minutes here to see. It did reverse itself a little bit. We're going to the 10-year yield, 1.55%. Everyone's expecting it to pop over 2. We have a lot of selling going on in the bond market. Auctions, I believe New England, the UK, had an auction, and they didn't do very well. And so you have the 10-year yield, 1.55%. European and Asian markets, well, the Asian markets were all down over 2%. London and Germany were down just a little bit, not much. And the Dow was down a little over 1%, 345, 30,924. The NASDAQ was down a little more, 2%, at 274, at 12,723. And the S&P was down 51 at 3,768. And it's just real interesting because whenever that stock market is down, you can usually see the Bitcoin drop also. That was down 5% today. So interesting because we saw what Bitcoin did also last March when the markets fell apart in the paper markets. So will it happen at the next fall apart of the paper markets? Probably, because there's no better safe haven than gold, especially when everybody knows the bond markets is in a bubble, and it's probably, I don't know which bubble is the biggest, but yet they keep pushing them, they keep selling them, they keep slapping them into your portfolios, and everybody knows it's just a matter of time until it corrects. But hey, until then, don't worry about it, be happy. Are you with us, Dave?
I'm here, Melody. Hello, everybody.
Hello. I want to start with what Jerome Powell said earlier, that he expects some inflationary pressures. What do they pay these guys again? In the time ahead, but they likely won't be enough to spur the Fed to hike interest rates. So we'll see. We expect that as the economy reopens and hopefully picks up, we will see inflation move up through base effects. This is what he told a bunch of attendees at a Wall Street Journal conference. And he says, well, you know, that could create some upward pressure on prices. Paper markets, of course, reacted negatively. We saw the markets dropping. You know what? 1% in the Dow is nothing. 2% really in the NASDAQ is really not that much. But it's a beginning. And we saw the Treasury yields jumping, and I think that's the most important part right there. Some investors and economists had been looking for him to address the recent surge in rates with maybe a possible nod toward adjusting the Fed's asset purchase program. Can't do that. Can't do anything with that $120 billion a month in treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. Can't reduce that, Dave.
Well, you asked how much a Fed governor gets. They're paid about $183,000. A year, the Fed chair is about a little over 203,000. Be that as it may, I mean, Powell reiterated.
Until they leave and can make millions and millions and millions of dollars on speaking engagements.
Well, there you go. So we'll call this an entry level salary.
Yes.
So Powell reiterated past statements he's made on inflation, certainly more recent ones, saying he doesn't expect the recent move up in prices to be either long lasting or enough to change the Fed from its, you know, easing monetary policy. He did note that the rise in yields did catch his attention. Hey, there you go. The wake up call, as well as improving economic conditions, mixed as they are. He did say there's good reason to think that the outlook is becoming more positive at the margins. As we all know, the Fed likes inflation to run around 2% as measured by the personal consumption index, expenditures index. That's a rate the Fed believes signals a healthy economy, as well as provides some room to cut interest rates during times of crisis like these, which has seen it at zero now for near zero for quite some time. However, the rate has run below 2% for most of the past decade, at least as reported by government. And inflation has been particularly weak during the pandemic, at least early on, although it has been rising for some times and is probably 2 to 3 more times the amount that's reported monthly by the government. I'll be talking a little bit more about inflation later in the program, Melody.
Yeah, I mean, almost everyone you talk to now, we look at the prices in the grocery stores, we're beginning to feel the impact. I mean, certainly, you know, you can see prices move up a little bit and, you know, it is what it is. But then you begin to feel the real impact. You're really beginning to see. And it's making a difference. It's getting people's attention that prices are rising. And he will be forced, Dave, I think, to raise rates. I mean, what else can he do if the inflation, I mean, the Fed always seems to be between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, I don't see him going there. I think too many of the governors would, I mean, not to say that they shouldn't, it just, I believe that too many governors would, I mean, barring, you know, a significant surge in over a 2 or 3 month period, I think they view it as a credibility problem because they've been saying for, you know, how long now? I mean, certainly the past year that, you know, they're going to keep rates as low as they are now for the indefinite future. And I think instead of that, and we'll talk about this a little bit later on. They're gonna, I think, sell some of the short term bonds that it owns and go longer out the yield curve and attempt to bring down longer term rates, thus hoping to stop inflation in its tracks. We will see.
Well, the only thing that they can do, well, does that push them into going to negative rates? I mean, if those yields continue to rise, is that going to force them to go into real negative rates?
Well, the problem is we're already there.
Well, not officially.
Well, real rates we are. Sure.
Oh, true.
I mean, nominal rates we're not, but yeah. You know, if you got nominal rates, even at the higher end, at say 0.25%, or it will take 1.5% at the 10-year yield. You know, so add in the roughly 2% inflation. It's not quite there, but it's over 1.5, even by the government.
Right.
So,
true.
So I, yeah.
But I mean, for them to actually go lower than, I mean, oh, I watched negative rates.
They won't go there. I don't think they'll go there.
You know, it's interesting. I was watching a Bloomberg discussion this morning from the central. I think he was a central bank person from England. I can't remember. He had an interesting name. I can't recall it. And it was really early this morning. But they were talking about negative rates and all the QE. And all the QE that these governments put into the system back in 2008, it just band-aided it over. It was just like, who are these? And they were talking about the negative rates.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pretty much saying, yeah, I mean, hey, just, you know, what you explained and, you know, was we're already there. But, I mean, officially, you know, it's... And that's the direction. And they were talking about how, you know, the negative rates really haven't helped. But that's where the United States is going to be headed. And it was kind of an interesting conversation because all they did was really talk about how the QE didn't work. And what they're doing now is only making the problems so much worse in the long run. And, you know, they talked about the employment rates. They were talking about, you know, these jobs. It's very questionable. Of the thousands and thousands and thousands of businesses that have closed, it's very questionable of who's going to be reopening.
Yeah.
And so the point of the whole thing is it's, you know, you hear all these, you know, happy predictions for growth. And that's what all these predictions are just for the, you know, the glory of the investors to make them happy so they don't sell and to keep these markets going. And it's just, I'm sure Jerome Powell will come out with a statement tomorrow to ease the markets, because I don't know who was in control of the Fed. Was it President Trump during his administration, or did he, you know, I mean, who knows? But I think in this administration, I think all the power went back to Powell. And so it's, and again, folks, I'm not supporting the Fed. And I'm not supporting, you know, the trillions of dollars. We finally went over 28 trillion that they admit to of debt. So there's a lot of little things going on in these markets. And just because gold and silver were down, yeah, these are knee-jerk reactions. And I think everybody's kind of waiting to see what's going to happen because everybody knows that there's something going on. That the markets aren't hitting record highs based on a great economy, on true fundamentals. And it's really sad because the people who don't do anything to protect what they have, and they also said that on this morning. He says, you know, when things correct, he says it's the little guy that gets hurt. The little guy gets hurt, and everybody knows it. All the big guys,
not so much.
Not so much. They don't care about the little guy.
Well, now gold's... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead with gold.
I mean, gold's the only thing that's really there for the little guy to protect yourself against the big guys. What are we going to say, Dave?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, you know, you just mentioned about the national debt. Was it the national debt hitting $28 trillion?
Yeah.
And here we are, the Congressional Budget Office out again this morning with a new update on the debt, saying, estimating it could double over the next 30 years. To $56 trillion. Now, what that means, and I used to work at CBO, just full disclosure, but the big forecasting houses like them tend to underestimate deficits and
timing,
and debt, especially over the last 15 years. And so, with no other additional policy changes, you double the debt in the next 30 years. That's just if that doesn't signal some kind of economic catastrophe between now and then, good Lord, I don't know what does.
Yeah, and you're right. The numbers won't. They're always underestimating, and of course the timeline too. I mean, look what we've done. Look what we've done in debt in the past. And there's no end to it. I'd say we'd hit that number probably in 5 years.
Good God.
Maybe not double, but double what was done in the past 4 years or since 2008. But anyway.
Well, you know, we got more stimulus to go. I mean, depending on how the economy shakes out 6 months from now, after vaccinations are rolled out in bigger numbers, you know, could even be more. There could be another 3 or 6 months of stimulus that the Congress and White House feel are needed to get us through until the, quote, end of the pandemic. And then, of course, you've got Washington, beginning to sit down and talk, not negotiating, but talking about the framework for an infrastructure program.
Yep.
You know, well, who knows we need a lot of infrastructure work done. I don't know how you pay for it.
Nope. Hey, Dave, I don't know how this time went by so fast. We're heading into the first break of the program. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to Financial Survival. Melody's left to take care of some customer business. Return business calls. So I'm going to be taking over for the rest of the program. We bid her a good evening for sure. If you need to do any business, Melody's at 1-800-375-4188. Good first segment. Some quality dialogue there. If I must say so myself. Thank you, Melody, for being the catalyst. One of the reports that came out today, before Powell made his comments about inflation, was another weekly jobless claims report. Showed that figures edged higher last week, but rose less than expected for an economy struggling to shake off impacts from the pandemic that's been around now for just shy of 1 year. The Labor Department reported today that first-time filings for the unemployment insurance in the week ending February 27th were 745,000. It's a touch below the estimate of 750, and a slight uptick from the previous week's upwardly revised figure of 736,000. Now, seasonably harsh winter storms in Texas took a toll on the labor market overall, resulting in an increase of about 18,000 filings for the state. Surprised it wasn't more, and I suggest next week's revised figures for that week will likely show an additional several thousand. Ohio and New York also saw considerable increases in claims. Now, continuing claims again decreased, falling by 124,000 to just below 4.3 million. So another pandemic era low in data that run a week behind the headline claims number. Economist Ian Shepherdson at Pantheon Macroeconomics, who we quote a lot on these figures, said, "We expected a substantially bigger rebound after the huge winter storm pushed claims down. So this reading suggests that the underlying trend in layoffs is falling, thanks to the reopening now underway across many states. As always, though," he continued, "two good weeks in this volatile series don't prove anything." Shepherdson added, "Whatever happens next week, we expect the trend to fall sharply over the next few months, provided the new COVID variants don't trigger a new spring wave in cases, and more importantly, hospitalizations." Now, today's report comes amid mostly mixed signals for the U.S. economy. Some might take issue with that. Whereas economists had been expecting slow growth to start 2021, followed by an acceleration in the middle of the year, estimates are now being revised upward rapidly. The exuberant Atlanta Fed's GDP Now tracker, for example, is pointing to 10% growth in the first quarter. 10%, that's a pretty big jump. That's a lot of production that's got to assume a lot more people heading back to work. So we'll see. I mean, still, fixing the jobs market has been the missing element thus far in the broader economic picture, not just here in the U.S., but around the world. Though our government's U6 unemployment rate, that's the rate that includes discouraged workers and those working part-time for economic reasons, that rate has tumbled from a pandemic era high of nearly 30%, in fact, over 30% last April, to around 11.6% in January. Still, there are huge gaps in employment. Yesterday's ADP payroll report showed that private hiring increased by just 117,000 last month. That's far below the estimate of 225,000. The Labor Department's expected to report tomorrow that non-farm payrolls grew by over 200,000, though the ADP number adds some downside risk to that one. Still, and here's the number to keep in mind, about 10 million unemployed workers are out there as of the end of February, and today's Labor Department report indicates more than 18 million Americans continue to receive some form of unemployment compensation as of February 13th. However, that total fell by just over a million, and that's due largely to a decrease in enrollees for special pandemic-related programs that provide benefits to those not normally eligible, like the self-employed, as well as those who've exhausted their regular state benefits. Now, another stimulus bill that the Senate's expecting to debate today through sometime this weekend. Actually, not today. They're not meeting today because of that the rumble out there in social media land about some possible violence. But the stimulus bill, they're using the House passed bill as the base for a discussion and consideration of amendments that contains new allocations for enhanced unemployment benefits. I think it's $400 per week in the bill passed by the House. Now, don't look now, but the average monthly loan for a new car is approaching $600. Wow. That's according to Experian. Melinda Zabritsky, she's senior director for Experian's Automotive Financial Solutions team, said, "We went up higher amounts year over year in 2020 than we ever have before and hit record highs in loan amounts and record highs in payments." Now, Experian's latest auto financing report covers the fourth quarter of last year when new vehicle sales improved, but we're still well below the pace of sales in 2019. Nevertheless, those taking out loans to buy a new vehicle borrowed an average of $35,200+, an increase of almost $2,000 from a year before. That's a sign of confidence, among other things. As a result, monthly loan payments jumped to a record high of $576. Loans for used vehicles also hit all-time highs, $24,467, and that's up almost $1,700 year over year. Experian says monthly payments for used auto loans jumped to $413. That's the first time that average topped $400. Britsky said she can certainly remember when $400 was the average payment for a new car, but those days are gone. Quote, "We're well over 400 now and don't expect to see that come down," unquote. Now, auto loans and payments are getting bigger because the price for all vehicles is rising, getting bigger at a pace few could have predicted just a few years ago. What's behind that higher sticker price? Well, for new vehicles, the demand for larger and more expensive SUVs and pickups means buyers are willing and are paying more. Buyers are also increasingly opting for models with more tech features like infotainment centers to driver assist systems. I was in my buddy's new car not too long ago. He has a vertical screen below his dashboard that I think is larger than my laptop. It's very impressive for when you're mapping, particularly if you have a passenger to spend the time to look at the details. Used car and truck prices are climbing due to greater demand during the pandemic. And that further tightened the already strong used car market, where approximately 40 million vehicles were sold last year. Now, despite the increased borrowing and higher payments, the number of consumers defaulting or falling behind in their auto loans remains below the historical average. That's a surprise. Zabriskie said consumers have done a good job of staying current and keeping those payments going, especially during these difficult times. Shout out to my own daughter for keeping up her car payment during the pandemic. Now, in a related story here, if you missed this yesterday, this story is a day old, Americans' feelings about the economy are turning up. That's according to the latest confidence survey from Hamilton Place Strategies and Civic Science. After 2 months of decreasing, economic sentiment climbed 2.2 points to 49.6 as COVID-19 cases, business restrictions, and, well, deaths continued to decline, while restaurant openings and vaccination numbers moved higher. In fact, all five of the economic sentiment index's indicators rose last week with a surge of 5.6 points in confidence in the U.S. economy, which rose to 55.4, its largest spike since September of last year. Now, confidence in the job market also hit its highest level since September, increasing 1.9 points, although to a lower 43.1. The consumer indicators of confidence in personal finances and making a major purchase rose 1.9 and 1.8 points, respectively. TD Bank told its clients easing of restrictions is being reflected in a fading of weakness in the open table restaurant series. It's now down 39% year over year, a notable improvement from a negative 52 just a month ago. Now, the 39% again is negative as well. Some credit card transaction data series shows are showing net strengthening this year, even with some weakening since early January. And mobility data from Google, which basically shows, you know, how people are on the move from their homes, are also signaling some strengthening. Now, let's see where to go next. Let's just talk about this because we've mentioned it over the past few weeks. Consumers in the world's largest economies have amassed almost $3 trillion in additional savings. Personal savings during pandemic-related lockdowns. It's a vast cash hoard that creates the potential for an eventual powerful rebound, if not recovery, from the worldwide recession. The households in the U.S., China, U.K., Japan, as well as the biggest Eurozone nations, namely Germany, sock money away when forced by COVID to stay home and out of shops. And they're likely continuing to do so as restrictions largely remain and Congress and other governments dole out additional stimulus. Now, half of that $2.9 trillion, a little bit more than half actually, $1.5 trillion and growing, is in the U.S. alone. And that's at least double the average annual growth of GDP seen in the last expansion and equivalent to the annual output of South Korea. Lockdown barriers to spending combined with stimulus-boosted incomes have left consumers with this massive pent-up savings. And these savings could provide fuel for economies to rebound once COVID-19 is finally wrestled under control. The optimists are betting on a shopping spree as people return to retailers, restaurants, entertainment venues, tourist hotspots, and sporting events. All of which they've held back on over the past year, in many cases because they had no choice. A lot of these places were closed, simply closed. Those who are less confident wonder if the money they've saved will instead have to be used to cover debts or hoarded until the health crisis passes altogether and labor markets once again look stronger. In the U.S., a running down of all the money saved in the past year would propel economic growth to as much as 9% rather than the 4.6 average currently projected for this year. And the 9%, of course, just a percentage point below the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now tracker that I mentioned earlier of 10%. But that's just in the first quarter. By contrast, if the savings go unspent, experts say the economy will likely grow by just 2.2. Now, where do we go? We have we're almost out of time. We'll save levity is golden for the beginning of the next segment. Let's talk about this survey, another survey which I find interesting. Not altogether surprising, but President Joe Biden, as we know, has inherited a complicated U.S.-China relationship that includes a prolonged and contentious trade war, mutually imposed sanctions on high-ranking officials, tensions flaring over human rights, the future of Hong Kong and Taiwan, the South China Sea, and an American public with deeply negative feelings toward that country. Roughly 9 in 10 U.S. adults, 89%, now consider China either a competitor or enemy rather than a partner. That's according to a new Pew Research Center survey. Many also support taking a firmer approach to the bilateral relationship, whether by promoting human rights in China, getting tougher on them economically, or limiting Chinese students studying abroad here at U.S. universities. More broadly, 48%, nearly half, think limiting China's power and influence should be a top foreign policy priority for the U.S. That's up by one-third from 32% just 3 years ago. Today, two-thirds of Americans have cold feelings toward China, giving the country a rating of less than 50 on a 0 to 100 scale. That's up from 46% who said the same in 2018. The intensity of these negative feelings has also increased. The share who say they have very cold feelings toward China, that's 0 to 24 on the same scale, has more than doubled from 23% to 47%. Hear the music. That means it's time to take another short break. Please stick around. We'll be back right after these few important messages. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody. The rest of today, while she takes care of client orders, give her a call. 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. Now it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. And if Melody is listening in, she's going to be saying, what are you thinking? No, it's not what you think, Melody, but you may wonder what this has to do with gold and silver. Well, not so much directly, but it has something to do at least with just the crazy way of life these days. Is overtime CEO Dan Porter losing his mind? That's me asking, not Melody. The sports company's co-founder recalled that reaction from the late National Basketball Association commissioner David Stern when he pitched establishing another professional basketball league. Overtime announced today that it plans to start a basketball league for, listen to this, 16 to 18-year-olds, allowing them to earn at least $100,000 a year. The Overtime Elite League, known in shorthand as OTE, will let players bypass traditional high school and collegiate levels while building their brand and presumably skills before becoming eligible for the NBA. It will start in September of this year with 30 players and will be based in a single location, which is still under discussion. Porter confirmed that Overtime would pay all health insurance and allow players to earn bonuses and equity in Overtime. He also recalled Stern's skepticism. It's a pretty interesting opportunity, Porter said, of starting OTE. Overtime distributes original sports content on social media outlets, including Snapchat, Google-owned YouTube, and Facebook-owned Instagram, and sells apparel with its logo and branding. Now, most of the content revolves around high school or other amateur players, but it doesn't license highlights or materials for major sports leagues. Porter and Zach Wiener, both former William Morris Endeavor executives, founded Overtime in 2016 with investments from Stern before he died, and as well as others. Since then, the company has built a massive Generation Z following from high school basketball players. The company has over 40 million followers across its social media channels and has built credibility among NBA stars like Zion Williamson of the New Orleans Pelicans and Atlanta Hawks point guard Trae Young. The company says its content is streamed more than 1.7 billion times a month across all social platforms, mostly Gen Z. Polls have suggested this group of 13 to 24-year-olders prefer highlights and quick sports content over traditional formats, and that they favor basketball over all other sports. Overtime's revenues come from two sources. One is directly aligning with brands by integrating them into its content and making money off video ads. The other is direct revenue via e-commerce, where Porter says the company makes millions of dollars from apparel. He said, just like a sports team, when you buy a hat or jersey, people feel a part of that community. and they buy apparel to represent that. We think there's a big opportunity to lean in what is at the core of basketball for young people and create an apparel brand. With OTE, Porter expects the revenue model to change a bit from e-commerce and media to e-commerce media rights and licensing, much like a regular professional league. He said OTE eventually wants to sell its media rights. Not early on, though, he said. We're going to take our time. Now, Overtime is also engaged in active talks for brand partners and distribution for the league, excluding the lucrative TV rights. This will be interesting. I've been talking for some time. The Division I college ranks of looking at different ways to allow certain players to accept either advertising money, branding money, what have you, without losing their amateur status. So this, I suspect, will be a big debate, at least among the sports fans out there in America. In any event, what will they think of next? And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, let's get back to the Fed for a minute. We alluded to this, but didn't get around to it because Melody actually and I talked about this during the first break. Now, even as global growth expectations increase and governments pile on fiscal spending measures, the Fed and other central bankers are quietly restarting recession-era bond buying programs. Comments the other day from Fed Governor Lyle Brainard suggest the Fed may be jumping on board the global monetary policy rethink and restarting a program used after the 2008 Great Recession. She said, "I'm paying close attention to market developments. Some of those moves last week and the speeds of the moves caught my eye." Brainard added that she would be concerned if she saw disorderly conditions or persistent tightening in financial conditions. Most mainstream economists say it's unlikely the Fed will reignite its QE program. I don't know what they're talking about. I mean, that's what they're heavily in the midst of in many respects right now. But as central banks in Australia and Korea have announced in recent days, but they believe the Fed could restart Operation Twist. Operation Twist 3, as it's been dubbed, because it would be the third time the Fed has used that tool, would see the Fed selling some of its treasury bonds with shorter maturities, probably in the 5 years and less, maybe even the 7 years and less maturities, and buying longer dated bonds, probably 10 years and later, all to flatten the yield curve as it did in 1962. And again in 2011. Well, why do that, you ask? Well, in addition to the technical benefits to the bond market, Operation Twist has historically stimulated the economy by pulling down the benchmark 10-year Treasury yield. Because most consumer interest rates, credit cards, auto loans, even mortgage rates, are set based in large part on the 10-year yield, Operation Twist could act as an accelerant for the economy. This isn't my opinion. This is mainstream economists. Without the Fed having to add to its balance sheet and risk the appearance of concern. Woe be that. But under the surface, despite the extraordinarily bullish expectations for booming economic growth in 2021, as we mentioned earlier in the program, rate-sensitive sectors of the economy are showing weakness. The housing market, for one, that slowed, with recent home sales numbers badly missing expectations. And at least one home price report noting that as supply-demand challenges continue to push home prices higher, we may see new barriers for some prospective buyers this year. Now, the rate for the 30-year fixed mortgage saw its largest single week increase in almost a year last week, rising to 3.23%. Auto sales are slowing after a weak 2020. With Edmunds.com estimating sales fell almost 3% last month due to smaller tax returns and higher car prices and interest rates. And credit card balances and other revolving credit lines fell by 11% year over year in December. That's the steepest decline ever, according to the Fed. In addition, to the lightning fast jump up in nominal U.S. Treasury yields, the Fed's also likely watching the continued rise in the five-year inflation expectations. While 10-year and 30-year break-even rates, which measure investors' expectations for inflation over those time horizons, while they've been capped in recent days as the bond market sell-off died down, five-year break-even rates have continued to surge higher. That rate touched 2.43% the other day, and that's the highest since May of 2011. Tuesday's remarks from Brainard were echoed by San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly, who told reporters after a speech that the Fed could change the maturity of its bond purchases if the yield curve steepens in a problematic way. So that's just my humble guess where this current conversation is going to lead the Fed in the coming months if they see inflation inching up too quickly. So rather than take interest rates above the 0 to 0.25% target range, I believe they'll leave them alone and go for this Operation Twist 3. And that's, all the while buying $120 billion a month, just that the Treasury portion of that will be, the longer-term maturities. Now, I was going to talk about how inflation's affected by supply chains. It's very interesting. I'll save that for another time, perhaps. There's one thing I wanted to talk about in the remaining minutes of the show. As you know, we've been reporting more and more on daily moves with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies just because of the I don't mean amazing in a necessarily positive aspect, although it's been just superlative gains. But as you know, both Melody and I are big skeptics of Bitcoin for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that we don't see it as a store of money whatsoever, and view it its use in the background in a very non-transparent environment for things that are not necessarily for the good of society. But here's something. It's going to be the hat trick of survey programs. A new survey by Cardify shows that particularly new investors in cryptocurrencies are doing hardly any research before jumping in feet first. Cardify used data collected from 750 Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency investors last month. Stretch, as you may recall, included the price of Bitcoin climbing from 37,000 to 47,000 per coin. But during that period, it found that only 17% of investors who have bought crypto fully understand the value and potential of cryptocurrency. That's an astounding less than one in five investors, ladies and gentlemen. Over one-third of buyers have either zero knowledge about that space or would call their level of understanding simply emerging. A lack of knowledge or understanding hasn't stopped people from buying virtual currencies, however. More than 40% of all crypto purchases come from new investors. And that's fueled in part by growing mainstream acceptance of crypto. In the past few months, both PayPal and Square, for example, have added it to their platforms, as have a couple of big hedge funds and other money managers. The survey results also suggest that many new investors have been spurred into action by the classic FOMO, fear of missing out on gains. But that, in many respects, is the nature of speculation. More than a third of survey respondents researched digital currencies for less than a month before buying, and one in four crypto holders told Quartify they were entering the space in the hopes of earning short-term financial gains. In other words, get rich quick. Now, investment volumes in January of this year were already 23 times higher than they were just 2 years ago, with an average purchase size growing to $1,200, compared to just $432 at the same point in 2020. That's when the price was significantly lower, in fact, right around $3,000. My point is here, although I'm out of time, is stay away from it, ladies and gentlemen, unless you've got money to burn. We've got a much better place for you to place it for the long term, gold and silver. That's all the time we have for today's program. I want to thank you for tuning in. I'll be back on Tuesday. Be on the lookout for our weekly blog and your email boxes tomorrow. Melody will be back with Butch. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Keep safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.